Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Lieutenant Colonel Charles Smith of the Salvation Army, Captain Nancy Powers, Carla Bell, and Pamela Harrell. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Nice to have you with us. Our phone lines will not be open tonight because this broadcast is recorded. However, if you'd like to send us some comments, we're always interested in your comments, and you can send them to Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. Well, tonight in the second hour, we're going to be talking about politics. But in the first hour in this holiday season, we're going to be talking about, I think, one of the most remarkable organizations really in the United States and really in the world. But we're going to be focusing, obviously, on what they do in Chicago and around the nation. Because what is a season all about, the holiday season all about, the Christmas season? It's about giving. It's about caring. It's about remembering those that are in need and celebration of life. And so tonight we're going to be talking with four representatives of, I think, a remarkable organization, the Salvation Army. They have been part of the Christmas season since 1891. And wherever you're listening around the country and watching, you know the bells, you see the kettles, you see people standing on corners when it's bitter cold. Hopefully every once in a while they're ringing their bells, but people are dropping money into those red buckets and red kettles. And so tonight we're going to sort of go beyond the kettle and sort of let you know what happens to the money when you put it in there. A lot of people are concerned about, well, we like to give to charity, but where does the money go? Well, tonight, at least in the first hour of our broadcast, we're going to talk a little bit about that. And we're going to begin by welcoming Lieutenant Colonel Charles Smith from the Salvation Army. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Bruce. It's good to be here.
And you are back in Chicago. You spent some years away from Chicago. You most right. recently came back from Kansas City but last October, just a couple of months ago. But tell us briefly about, when you talk about the structure of the Salvation Army, how many different programs, how many different people are involved in, and it really is all over the world, is it not?
It is over all the world. We're over in 120 different countries around the world. We started off in London, England, but very fast moved right to the United States in 1880, and next year is the 150th anniversary of the Salvation Army.
And what was the origin of its founding?
Well, the origin of its founding was with William Booth, who was the founder of our organization. He was a Methodist minister and felt a compelling desire to help the man on the street who was suffering in need, and developed a street ministry that was originally called the Christian Mission. And through a stroke of inspiration, changed it to becoming the fact that we're in a war against sin and we should become the Salvation Army. So in 1865, we started as the Salvation Army.
And to those who are without a religious belief, is that a requirement for help from the Salvation Army?
Actually, no. We serve without discrimination. That's part of our mission statement. Anybody that is in need, the need is what determines the assistance. But in the Salvation Army, it's all driven by our desire to serve man because of our love for God.
Now, the rest of our guests this evening, I'm going to talk briefly with Carla Bell. She is Director of Emergency Assistant Care Management. And what exactly does that mean, Carla, and who are the people that you primarily serve?
Well, thank you for asking that question. We serve everybody. Anybody that comes to us that has a need, and we start where the client is. So we don't assume that we have all the answers. We ask the client, what is it that's keeping them from being self-sufficient? And they can identify, I need some help with rent or lights, or I need education, I need clothing. And we start from there and make a case plan. So we don't have a one-size-fits-all plan. And I think that's what makes us a little different than other places. And that's one of the things I find exciting about my work. And then from there, we figure out what are the steps that it takes to get the client from A to B, and then from B to C. Usually our clients are with us two or three contacts if it's emergency assistance. The first is to identify the problem. The second is to put the plan together. And the third is to actualize it.
So if someone is, for whatever reason, evicted, if someone is caught in a fire and they have no place to go, no family, I mean, they would go primarily to you and your programs?
They would come to any of our doors because we have an open door policy. So if it's a fire, they may be seen by our emergency disaster services team who picks them up, passes them on to us along with Red Cross, and we begin to start from there. If they show up at a shelter program, like in the case of the Booth Lodge with Pamela's program, they'll start with there, and then we'll begin to help them recover. So it depends on where they show up, but we do provide case management from that first call, and I think that's important to know.
Captain Nancy Powers joins us. She is a Corps officer for Harbor Light. Again, if you live in the Chicago area, you're familiar with the Harbor Light mission. Tell us more about the mission of that mission.
Harbor Light is exciting because we're a stair-step program. We have mobile units out on the streets 365 days of the year. We are out where the homeless folks are. We are seeing them in their natural environment, offering them a hot meal, offering them a blanket, maybe clothes, maybe boots, hats. But with that, it's an opportunity to get to know them and form a trust bond so that maybe they'll go with us to detox. Maybe they'll go with us to see a doctor. Maybe they'll take us up on the offer to come into Harbor Light to substance abuse treatment. We will offer them anything that they need to get off those streets on a permanent basis. If they need detox, we'll take them to detox and then into our substance abuse treatment program.
And once they acknowledge that they are ready for some help and you bring them in off the street that night, how long does that client stay with you?
That's up to the client. Our intensive program is an average of 30 days, but they can actually stay for up to 4 to 5 years because they didn't become addicted overnight. Most of our clients started using when they were 9 or 10 years old and have a life of abuse. And so it's not just getting over the substance, but it's learning how to do a lot of different life skills to be successful on their own.
What is the biggest fear that they have? Because, again, I think everyone, certainly living in the Chicagoland area, I've mentioned there's, I think, the increase in homelessness that I run into from, you know, where I live and where I walk in the city is dramatically increased from, let's say, 10 years ago. And I've been told, and sometimes I've had conversations with homeless people, and they just say, well, they like life on the street. Do they like life on the street because there's a freedom? Do they like life on the street because they don't know any better? Are they fearful of taking help from someone like the Salvation Army? Are there trust issues? What keeps someone on the street if they really don't have to be on the street and they could be under a Salvation Army umbrella of love?
Obviously, everybody's a little different. But on the average, people don't like rules. They don't want to be told what time to come in or what time to get up or where to go to lunch. They also don't have a lot of trust. They maybe have a bag full of belongings and they want to make sure they're safe. So there's a certain fear.
I want to continue our discussion and meet other guests as well. Thank you for joining us. This is a holiday edition of Beyond the Beltway. No calls tonight, but again, talking about the role of the Salvation Army and all the good they do for people all over the world. Back shortly from Chicago.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
Back in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us tonight. We're talking about the Salvation Army and the work they do. When you put your money in that red kettle, you want to know where it goes. We're talking about some of the services that they provide. And Pamela Harrell also joins us. She is volunteer staff training coordinator at the Evangeline Booth Lodge. And what is the Booth Lodge, and who is your primary clientele?
At the Evangeline Booth Lodge, Bruce, we serve homeless families, whether it's a single male with children, single female with children, or a couple, but the key is with children. And the two main goals of our clients that we have for our clients at the lodge is financial stability and safe permanent housing. And there's many steps that we have to take to get them to that point, whether it's mental health, whether it's sending them to the doctor because of physical ailments, past gas bills that can keep them from getting housing, domestic violence situations, an eviction, a foreclosure. So there's many reasons.
When somebody, and you just ran through a litany of horrible experiences,
yes,
that anyone have. Okay, so when they come in and they've shared the problem with you, what do you do? Because how many of these services are dealt with in the building that they walked in to meet you?
Maybe half of their issues are dealt directly within the building, and sometimes
you have medical, you have doctors or nurses that are there?
We can bring doctors, for example, with a child that can't get in school because they never had a physical or immunization. So we have to bring, you know, different organizations in for that. And then sometimes we have to call on Carla Bell for help and pull her into the problem. And some of the issues are even giving referrals outside of the facility as well.
Do you, Nancy, do you sometimes, obviously you're a human being, so there's attachments that happen to people that walk through your life every day. But are there some unique stories that you recall that you met someone when they were really down and out, and they got their life together and they came back, and you're part of their life and they're part of your life?
We have hundreds of stories, and I think that's why I love the Salvation Army so much, is that our help is not temporary. You know, get you over dinner tonight and then you're on your own. We're there. You are part of our family. We are part of your family. And take my hand, and we're going to walk this together. You know, sometimes you may not need us, you know, for emergency assistance. Maybe you're going to bring your child to camp this summer. Maybe you're going to come to a church service or put your child in one of our character building programs. So we're going to get to know you over years. We have one story that Pam and I laugh about all the time. We had a gang leader when we were working in the uptown area, and his gangs were selling drugs all around our facility, and it was causing quite a hassle. And we spread the word and said, please come and see me. And he came in, and we said, please don't do that anymore, and just explained what the hassles were, because our clients were being hurt and it was not a good atmosphere. And he agreed that for one block around our center, there would be no drug sales. And in return, you know, when he needed toys for his daughter at Christmas, he could apply for Angel Tree if his family or any of his guys. So it worked out. And
he also became heavily involved with the Salvation Army as well, to the point that now he still keeps in contact with us. And that's been 10 years at least now. He's living in Minnesota, working in a church, and now he has full custody of his daughter. So that's just one example of how Salvation Army changed lives.
Just in our conversations, we've already touched on probably at least a dozen different programs that you're involved in. How many total programs, Colonel, does the Salvation Army have in the United States?
Well, the Salvation Army really has a good neighbor policy. And what you'll find in every community is the Salvation Army might have a little different look. It's the same Salvation Army, but it's a different look because we try to take care of those particular needs. One of my appointments happened to be in Wichita, Kansas. And in Wichita, Biddy Basketball was a huge program that the Salvation Army offered for about 2,400 kids. And it's actually three generations old. So you had grandfathers, fathers, and sons and daughters all participating in this program. So if you ask somebody in Wichita, what's the Salvation Army? They'd say it's Biddy Basketball. You go to several other places, you'd find that it might be a children's shelter. Or here in Chicago, it might be the Emergency Lodge or the Freedom Center. It depends upon what door you enter in for the Salvation Army. I've said many times, someone's impression of who the Salvation Army is really depends what door you enter. Mm-hmm. And that's what they identify us with.
Now, one door, again, we've been talking about people in need, and we're talking about abused women and children and people that have been thrown out of their house because of eviction or a fire or for a variety of reasons. But there's one group that may not have a very sympathetic, at least public perception, and that is men and women who have served time in prison. Mm-hmm. And they're now going to be released. And I think the general term is halfway house. I think it's now called reentry homes. Now it's a little bit different. But what unique problems do they have, and what services do you provide for them, Captain Powers?
Coming out of a corrections facility sometimes is just like walking from a world of, you know, gun smoke to a world of Star Trek, literally, because you haven't seen the changes that slowly came into the world. And so suddenly you are put out with what's this internet, what's this, you know, the whole mm-hmm. application online doesn't make sense to you.
Right.
And so part of what we are doing is giving this person a safe haven, a room and meals and the services they need to figure out how to adapt to modern society, but also the time that they need to assimilate. It may be getting an email address and learning how to do an application. It may be figuring out what relationship they have to their spouse or their children or
behind.
Their parents mm-hmm. and give them
time. Are those
time.
Left behind, are those, do they frequently leave men and women who have been incarcerated?
It depends on the family and the relationship that they choose to have and how long the person's in there and what they, you know, every
so
family
So the reentry
is,
program is not just a place to stay and eat?
No. It's
a lot more.
Is it
required as part of the release program by the state or federal institutions?
Ours is a federal program and
federal.
It is
so you
mandated.
Just federal. Okay.
It is mandated. But the difference with the Salvation Army, and I don't care which program you pick and choose from, is there's a very different air. A couple of my employees were talking to me who recently came from other agencies. And they said that working for the Salvation Army, they do the same things. They write the treatment plans. They do the case management. They make the referrals. But it's a different world. It's not about making sure that our agency gets the best funding. It's not about making sure that the agency gets top billing. It's not about the agency at all. It's about the client. It's about loving that client, about
exactly.
doing the best that that client needs, even if it may not be the best for our agency.
Carla, how important is religion and a sense of God and God's love of all people?
Well, we love on people wherever they are. And if a person comes to us and asks for that spiritual guidance, we give it to them. If they say they haven't been connected to their church, we do that. But the love comes in how we serve. And I think that's what Captain Nancy was talking about. Mm-hmm. So in the example of the person coming out and being reentried, a lot of people say, oh, he had, you know, a prior history. We don't want to be bothered with him. We bring him in. We set him up. We get him some clothing. We help him with transportation. We set a network for him that's a positive uplifter and not the same people that he came from who may or may not be supportive in the new journey. So I think
now
that's
there,
how we show
now
it.
There are other entities. As you say, you are working with a federal program,
yes.
state institutions.
Yes.
How many other – there's a wide variety of people that have a contract to do this. Do you have – is your contract nationwide in this particular field?
Our clients come from anywhere in the federal government.
But how different would your reentry program be from one running from some agency, XYZ agency?
As far as the mandated programs that we have, not significantly different because that's part of the contract. How those are implemented are light years different.
Now, again, people, at least in the Chicagoland area, your facility, Nancy, is the facility. The Harbor Light Mission is this huge building at the corner of Ashland and Monroe. I understand you're about to get a new building.
Oh, yeah.
We'll talk about that in the moment. But how many people are in that building on any particular night in the four or five programs that you administer just in that building?
Just in the building, there are about 400 people.
And how is that divided up?
About 200 in the corrections program, about 200 in various stages of substance abuse treatment.
And what about at the Booth Hospital? What would the numbers be there?
The Booth Lodge is currently 200 clients there residing currently.
Okay. The total number of people, Colonel, that would be being serviced in some way by Salvation Army on any one particular night, at least in Chicago. I mean, obviously people can extrapolate what that would be nationally. I mean, we're talking about several thousand people a night?
I would say easily, because part of our service is not just those that are under our roofs. You know, one of our goals is hopefully to keep them in the community. And so serving them is also just as important.
I want to talk about that in-home, the in-home aspect of the Salvation Army as well. I'm Bruce Dumont, again, recorded broadcast this evening. Hope you're enjoying it. And again, this is called Beyond the Kettle. When you put that money in the Salvation Army kettle, where does that money go? We're talking about it tonight, back shortly from Chicago.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King this holiday season. Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us, and we hope that as you prepare for your Christmas holiday season coming up this week, you will remember the less fortunate. We all know there's been so much focus on commercialism in American society, and it is an important part of the free enterprise system. But I think certainly if you're of my generation, something also that is really synonymous with Christmas is the spirit of giving. And, you know, the red kettle and the bells and the people who have strong dedication out there when it's bitter cold, at least in the Chicagoland area, ringing the bell and hoping that people will come by and drop some money into their bucket. And again, at least two or three times a year, every holiday season is sort of a typical Salvation Army story. Is there'll be a story that somebody puts, you know, a couple of gold coins in there, or $1,000 bill, or $300,000 check, or whatever the case may be. There's those grand slam home run moments.
Yeah.
But again, that's what we're talking about tonight: is where do the money goes, and some of the people and the compassion that is and certainly should be part of this season. And again, we live in a great country. It's been very good to a lot of people, and this is the time of season to give back. And it's as close to you as the nearest kettle. And also, if you want to support the Salvation Army, you can go to their website, which is onlineredkettle.org, onlineredkettle.org, or if you want to give them a call, it's 1-800-SAL-ARMY. 1-800-SAL-ARMY. Let's meet our guests. Lieutenant Colonel Charles H. Smith, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, my wife and I are the divisional leaders for the Chicago Metropolitan Division, which includes northwestern Indiana as northeastern Illinois. We've been officers for nearly 38 years. I was born and raised in Kansas City, Missouri, and fourth-generation Salvationist. My parents brought me to the Salvation Army as our church home when we were when I was just a baby. Currently have two married adult children and five grandchildren, and they all live here in the Chicago area, so that's a great thing to be back home in Chicago.
And your children, tell us about your children and where they were born.
Well, interestingly enough, the divisional headquarters for the Salvation Army here in Chicago happens to be the former Booth Hospital, which was a home for unwed mothers. And in those days, it actually operated as a maternity hospital. And back in 1978 and later in 1980, both of our children were born, and they were born in the place where I now work and serve as our divisional headquarters.
Good story. Carla Bell, tell us about yourself.
Well, I'm a lifelong social worker. My parents were social workers and teachers, and I think that came with the genetics. I've been a social worker in Chicago for 37 years and employed with the Army for 21. And one of the reasons that I love it is because we help people wherever they are. I enjoy talking to people and meeting new people, so I have the best of both worlds. I'm married, and I have a daughter who is 28 and a nurse at Lurie Children's Hospital. And my husband is involved with food service at United Center, and all three of us have volunteered for the Salvation Army. My husband got involved really intimately during the time that we had Katrina evacuees here. The Salvation Army served for 10 days, 24 hours a day during a stand down for evacuees, and he had a chance to see us at work, so now he is a true fan.
Captain Nancy Powers.
Well, thank you very much for letting us be here. I am a Salvation Army officer because I chose the Salvation Army as my vehicle for service for the Lord. My husband and I are privileged to be the officers and administrators at the Salvation Army Harbor Light Center. We absolutely love the opportunity to work with the homeless and those in need of addiction services. We have two children who just think they have a lot of really odd aunts and uncles. They have no clue that they're not really related to all of these folks. They grew up in the Salvation Army. One works for the Salvation Army now. One did for quite a long time. And I have a granddaughter who just thinks also that she has quite a few odd aunts and uncles.
Pamela Harrell.
I've been employed with the Salvation Army since November 1st of 2001. I'm currently employed at the Evangeline Booth Lodge. I'm a mother of one 21-year-old daughter who's in her senior year in college, yes. And I am a fully ordained minister. I was born here in Chicago. I have roots in Georgia. And now I'm here with the Salvation Army, helping the Army to meet the needs of people without discrimination.
I want to ask sort of an odd question here. We live in a very rough world. We certainly as a nation have gotten over the issues of what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, and what happened in New York, and people in the streets, and feelings of distrust and abuse and a lack of justice from many African Americans for the Justice Department. And we also, throughout the year, we hear stories about news basically is about bad things that happen. And sometimes the bad things that happen are done by bad people. What we're talking about tonight are good people who help people who are unfortunate, who may be victims by bad people. And I'm just wondering, just personally, several of you have mentioned, you know, religion or a love of God as part of your testimony, as part of this broadcast this evening. But how do you, as people who are on the good side of life, how do you personally sort of get yourself up personally to deal with some of the horrible things that you may see and run into in the course of your daily job? Colonel?
Well, I think, first of all, general population has a great trust in the Salvation Army. They believe that we are good people, we do good things, and that opens quite a few doors for us. I can't necessarily speak for everyone. I think that I could speak for the folks that are here, that we're able to find ourselves in given situations to go in even without fear, because people have opened the door to us. They know that we have a love for people, a care for their needs, and even in the most destitute of situations, I can find a sense of being comfortable, safe, knowing that we're doing what God wants us to do.
Carla, how would you answer that question?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because even the crustiest person that I've met, I can find something joyful about them, and I usually have to. My department ends up being the complaint department, but usually there's a valid reason behind that complaint. So I start off with, bless your heart, I know you've got something that we need to figure out together, so let's do that. And then I let them tell their story, and I'm empathetic to what they've gone through. And then I say, let's do it together. So I try to find something good, because nobody is 100% crusty all the time. There's something joyful about it, and so I try to find the joyful place within me and the joyful place within them, and we work on that from together. And sometimes there's only one little joyful thread there, but we're going to find it and work it. Today a man told me, how many times do I have to go through the voicemail before somebody answers me? He never even talked to me before, but I just apologized for whoever he talked to and said, let's figure it out together. Didn't belong to my department, but I linked him to the right one.
How do you, Nancy, question to you is how do you get over it? And how, as part of what you do every day, people who come to you for assistance, it's not intended for you to become or them to become dependent on you. You're there as literally the ultimate safety net, and yet some people can become a safety net, can become a hammock.
I also want to address your last question, if you will let me.
Sure.
I think you had a little faulty of a premise. You see, I was born very much a sinner. I am not a good person. And God saw something in me that made him reach out to me 2,000 years ago. And if he could find something good in me worth sending his son for, that same God loves that crusty person as much as he does me. And if God can save me, he certainly can do the same thing. And maybe my job is to let that person know that somebody loves them. And it's more than me, that there is a God that loves them. And they may never have heard that news. Last night, I hugged 4 gang members, and they were not necessarily happy about it, by the way. Early 20s, I mean, just as sulky and rough
as it
comes.
Why were they there?
Because it was a funeral repass, and we had the family couldn't afford it, so we offered to do it for free for the family, and they came because their friend had been murdered. And so they were there doing the gang thing, and I hugged them and told them how much they were loved and that God loved them and that there was an option to this kind of life. And I shoved a card in their hand and told them, you call me and we'll talk anytime, day or night. And I put my cell phone number on it. And, you know, they probably dumped it in the trash as they walked out the door, but maybe one of them kept it. And if they call me at 3 a.m., I'm there. But it's because God saved me, because I was just as much a sinner. So how do I do it? It's because I know what it feels like to be forgiven. So that just inspires me to want to run out down the street screaming and yelling and hollering, come on, come on, come on. Let me tell you what the possibilities are. And we have seen it. We have seen it. The gang member that Pam and I talked about, before I left that particular appointment, I called him in and I handed him a Bible and I'd had his name engraved on it. And I said to him, I have to tell you the plan of salvation before I leave here. What you do with it is your job. And he was a little too rough to pray with me that day, but a week later he called Pam.
Yes.
And the two of them prayed.
He still had that Bible to this day. He had that same Bible.
I want to hear your story when we come back as well. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. We are recorded, no calls. And by the way, coming up after the network news, we are going to be talking about politics and looking ahead to 2015. But tonight, on this particular portion of our program, we're talking about the Salvation Army.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Welcome back. Thanks very much for joining us. And we want to get to Pamela Harrell and her story about what do you do when you're down and you're sort of overwhelmed by the troubles of the people that you are trying to serve? How do you get yourself on track?
Similar to Captain Nancy, I just remember that I'm just a sinner saved by grace. And I think back of the people that have sown a seed in me. And it's not that hard to lift someone's spirit. Good morning. How are you today? You look wonderful today. It's just a kind word that comes from the heart, because what comes from the heart will touch the heart. Mm-hmm. And that's how I deal with it. And I just thank God that, you know, he have blessed me to be in a home and away from street life.
Let me ask for those, and we probably don't have people watching or listening to the broadcast tonight. They may be listening to the broadcast, probably not watching, who are homeless. But they may be homeless someday. They may be burned out of their house someday. They may be evicted and not be able to pay the gas bill. They may have someone in the family who is in need of medical treatment. I mean, there's so many ways in which people who have comfortable lives can have those comfortable lives just taken away in a second. So there isn't anyone listening or watching tonight that can't someday find themselves in a position where they may want and need the Salvation Army. And I'm wondering, in doing that, what is the biggest misconception, Colonel, about the Salvation Army? Because let me add one. I've asked you the question. Let me answer it, then you can rebut my answer. And that is that some people, as great as the testimonies to Jesus Christ have been tonight, they rebel against religiosity in all ways. How important is that? And when someone is serviced by the Salvation Army, are they required to hear these stories?
No, they're not required to. I can tell you back to our founder. He said, how can you get a person to listen to the gospel message if their stomach is grumbling so loud they can't hear it? And so we do look at the need, and at the very beginning, you know, what is the need that this person is bringing to us, that their crisis point, and us addressing that. Our feeling oftentimes is that we demonstrate our love for Christ usually verbally as much as we do through our action. And we hope that people can sense that by the way in which we treat them.
We have people listening all over the United States. They could be in Spokane, Washington, Youngstown, Ohio, Palm Springs, Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, up in New Hampshire, Lebanon, New Hampshire. Money that is contributed to the Salvation Army in those communities, including obviously Chicago, does the money that is contributed in that community stay in that community?
It depends upon the donor's wishes. We allow it to be driven by the donor. If the donor wishes,
what about the kettle money? Is that
kettle money stays locally? In every place, it stays locally. But if a donor specifically asks for their money to go to a certain program or to a certain Salvation Army location, that certainly gets moved in that fashion. That especially worked with disaster services. Any money raised in Chicago for like Katrina did not stay in Chicago. It went to serve the people impacted by Katrina.
If there is someone who is homeless, is it safe to say that if they want to have a roof over their head that night, there is some place where they can go and get it in the city of Chicago?
Yeah. And with
maybe the Salvation Army, or it may be other. There are other groups that do good work out there. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, if someone is homeless and they don't stay there because of a mental inability to want to help themselves, there is a place for them to stay.
There is a place if they call the 311 system. They will find a place for them to stay.
And one would think that if you are living and your life has been on the street, Carla, that the word is out that people who are on the street probably know where these places are, whether they're the Salvation Army or the Pacific Guard Mission or other. So they know how to get there if they want.
And they connect to us in different ways. They may see Captain Nancy's program when they do frontline feeding, because there are hot meals that are being provided throughout the city 7 days a week. They may call us or call one of our centers. So we'll meet them wherever they are.
Now, we've been talking about some of the real, you know, heart-wrenching things that you do. But also my recollection is you have carolers. You tell us about that. We'll end on a high note here. There's caroling. Now, what is that intended for? Just to bring a spirit of holiday to those less fortunate?
Sure. We have just had a group last night of high school students that came out and actually went out with mobile feeding. And they went caroling just to bring joy. And they went out with mobile feeding and sang as people were getting their hot meals. Pretty neat.
Can you order them to come? Can you book them?
Yes.
Can you book them to come and sing for you?
Actually, this group of high school students have been coming out with us for about 6 years. They make sandwiches over several weeks. They collect hats, gloves, scarves. They're a great group.
One last question. What's a 10-second answer? What do you think is the biggest misconception about the Salvation Army?
Well, perhaps you've raised it already. One of the misconceptions often is that because people may be aware of our religious affiliation, being a part of the Christian church, that would prevent them from being served. And that is not the case.
We must remember this is a season of celebration, and it is a season of compassion and giving. And again, hopefully many of you listening are doing very well, or your life, this has been a good year for you. If you want to help, one of the most reputable organizations that have been around since 1891 is the Salvation Army. You can help them by going to online, redkettle.org, or giving them a call at 1-800-SAL-ARMY. Thank you all for being with us tonight.
Thank you
all for doing the work that you do. Speaking for everyone else and speaking for anyone that's ever been helped by the Salvation Army. Keep doing what you're doing. I'm Bruce Dumont. We're going to be back with another show in the next hour. And if you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight, we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King this holiday season. Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.
Live from Chicago, it's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont with Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasion injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our illustrious panel. This hour, John McCarron, longtime writer for the Chicago Tribune, now a professor at DePaul University. Dan Miller, longtime editor at a number of publications here in Chicago, and now a Chicago innovation expert and soon-to-be replacement TV host for Beyond the Beltway.
While Bruce is in California visiting family.
Sunny Southern California, that's right. And we've got Charles Lipson, former chairman and current professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago. Great to have you here, Charles, as well. Joining us on the phone this hour, we're happy to welcome Mark Flessner, a partner at Holland & Knight, a former federal prosecutor and someone who has spent a good deal of time on the issues of cyber safety, cybersecurity, and indeed cyber terrorism. Thank you, Attorney Flessner, for making time to join us on the program this evening.
You are welcome. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, of course, this part of the program, having discussed Cuba and events in New York City in the first hour, this part of the program is going to be devoted to an explication of the actual events and the significance of the Sony hack, which our president, Barack Obama, has said involves the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, also known as North Korea. I want to turn to Mark Flessner to get us started off on the hacking element of this story. Do we think, Mr. Flessner, do we think that this was something North Korea could have done on its own?
Well, I have no idea. North Korea's capabilities are, I think, not very well known because it's such a sequestered country. I assume the CIA or the DIA or some of the intelligence agencies know what their capabilities are. Obviously, the average layperson in the United States can opine about this as much as they want, but they're never going to get the kind of intelligence information, need to know what happened. The FBI is saying that
they have leaked information that the hackers are actually North Koreans who are based in China. Do you know anything about that?
No, I mean, I know the FBI is speculating. It's been rumored in the press this is a North Korean based security breach. But I mean, again, the security agencies tell the public what they want the public to know, not necessarily what the truth is,
nor what they know.
That may well be too.
right. Nor what they know. But some element of North Korea, we understand, maybe other elements. But Mr. Flessner, what is your immediate reaction upon hearing perhaps 8-9 days ago that Sony had been hacked in this way?
Well, my immediate reaction was shame on Sony. Sony is a very sophisticated company, and presumably they have cybersecurity in place, and whoever was in charge of their cybersecurity failed. It's more of a failure of the company than it is anything else.
Aren't you blaming the victim for the problem? How Mark, this is Dan Miller. How, in what sense is Sony culpable?
Well, we live in a world of that we have to all have cybersecurity. Every company, every law firm, every medical office, everybody has to protect their data information, their online information, because we live in a world of where these attacks come all the time. This is not something new, and it would be naive for us to sit here and think that Sony didn't realize that they, as well as any company in the world, could be the victim of cybersecurity. I mean, we hear this every day in the media. So, I mean, you say we're blaming the victim. Maybe, but it's realistically, they're the ones that should have prevented this from allowing themselves to be hacked.
Well, I want to get back to that in a second, but John McCarron has got a question for you, Mr. Flester.
Sure. Yeah, Mark, I was curious whether you thought this was something that a sophisticated party could do strictly from the outside using invasive software, or was there an insider here, a Snowden or a, you know, Julian Assange type of person who walked out with a disk or a thumb drive or something like that?
Well, I mean, again, I know what you know, which is in the media, there's been no reports of any kind of insider participating in that. This is the kind of thing, we're speculating on limited information, but this is the kind of thing that could be accessed from the outside. I mean, these cyber attacks can come, you know, at all angles at all times. So it's certainly not fantasy to think that they were able to infiltrate the Sony system from the outside.
Charles Lipson.
I think there are a couple of things to bring up here. One is that Sony is a Japanese corporation, and the North Koreans have spent a lot of time trying to penetrate into Japan. They have a lot of agents there and the rest, and there's quite a possibility that they had somebody inside. The people I've talked with in cybersecurity and web development have told me that the amount of information that was downloaded goes well beyond what individual or even a small group of hackers could do. This needed state support. Sony was apparently aware that there were attempts to penetrate them, but the information I have is that probably on the order of 95% of American corporations would have been penetrated by these kinds of attacks. So it wasn't that they had that their password was 12345. I mean, they had taken obviously not enough effort, and I gather this was not an extremely sophisticated attack. This wasn't like Stuxnet. But this is very disturbing, partly because Sony caved and partly because it was accompanied with terroristic threats, and finally because of the impact that it has on free speech in this country, which I think we'll get to after we get to
Let me just go back to something that – this is Dan Miller, Mark, or for listeners. You said that it's unlikely, I think, if I'm extrapolating what you said, that this could have been done inside North Korea because of their limited technology. These people the hackers are stationed outside. Are you suggesting that there are other players other than North Korea who aided and abetted, not just offering aid and comfort, but actually were pushing the buttons and making it happen?
What I understand, this is Charles Lipson, what I understand is that their access to the web is so weak that essentially everything goes through China, and that the people that China, for example, has its own hacking group that's a part of the PLA, the People's Liberation Army. The North Koreans have that, and they are stationed in China.
And that was Charles Lipson. We're speaking with Mark Flessner tonight, Dan Miller, John McCarron. This portion of Beyond the Beltway is focusing on the Sony hack. We're going to want to hear from you. We'll give you our phone number after this break. We send our season's greetings. It's Chris Roebling in for Bruce Dumont. Please stay with us.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City.
at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
Good evening. This is Chris Roebling on Beyond the Beltway. And thanks for joining us. Also on the program this evening, Dan Miller, John McCarron, Charles Lipson. Joining us by telephone is Mark Flessner, a partner at Holland & Knight and a former federal prosecutor. Our phone number is 1-800-723-8289. That is 1-800-723-8289. Our email address is btb@museum.tv. btb@museum.tv if you want to talk about the Sony hack, or if you still want to talk about the opening to Cuba, please give us a call. We'd love to hear from you a little bit later on in the program. Mr. Flessner, you are there. You can hear us?
Yes, I can.
Terrific.
Thank you.
So can you help the listeners understand what steps would be taken by your colleagues, the federal investigative team, presumably multi-agency, out in Los Angeles, now that this penetration of Sony is well understood to have happened? What are the steps the L.A. field office, so to speak, would be taking relative to this penetration of Sony?
Well, I assume the FBI and other intelligent agencies are trying to pinpoint the exact source of the penetration or penetrations, if there were more than one. There probably was, actually. And once they're able to identify the sources, that information is going to go up through the halls in justice and then presumably reported to the White House, and the White House is going to take some action, apparently, from what the president has reported, what they're calling a proportional response. I mean, I don't get me wrong. I think this is a very serious thing. I think it's a serious thing for many of the reasons that you've all identified, that it inhibits free speech, the First Amendment, that it threatens our industries in the United States. But it's also a reality that all companies know that cybersecurity is a huge issue. I mean, it's the new way of conducting war, isn't it? It's a new way of invading.
Well, we have you for this segment, so I'm going to take the initiative and ask you about this question we've seen batted around in national conversations about this event, which mm-hmm. is, what is a cyber act of war?
Well, I don't think this was it. I think this was simply a data security breach. And, it's incumbent upon the private company to protect their own data and their own private information.
And I want to ask you a question on that. I want to challenge you on that because it doesn't ring true to me. The United States federal government is here to protect us in our property and in our persons. And that's why we have borders, and that's why we have territory and sovereignty. Those are all basics. Now, obviously, those basics much predate cyber attacks. But
right.
Isn't there some sort of federal responsibility to protect our, say, at the very least, our national institutions, but presumably also our big companies that are operating here, maybe our public utilities that are here, or just individual Americans? Are we just supposed to be exposed, notwithstanding claims of jurisdiction by the United States federal government?
I can tell you that companies are taking it upon themselves, as is the grid, the infrastructure, that these companies are taking upon themselves to protect their proprietary information that it is not hacked. I mean, they have very sophisticated people they hire to do that. I don't think we want the federal government to have access to all of private companies' IT information in order to conduct the necessary security for that kind of protection. I think we have to rely on companies to do that. But to answer your first question, an act of cybersecurity or a cyber terrorism, to me, would be what you alluded to would be attack on the electrical infrastructure, the grid, or some other public utility which would really cripple the economy of the United States, as opposed to making a threat or onto a specific company.
Mark, this is Dan Miller. For the sure. sake of further argument, let's let that go. What retribution, what act of revenge or punishment, if any, do these hackers, what are they liable for? And in what sense should the U.S. government or Sony be the agents of putting that punishment on?
I doubt that Sony is going to be the only tool by which Sony would be able to exact punishment on these would be through the legal system, right? And I doubt that this is ever going to come up. The evidence of this is ever going to be such that Sony's going to be able to file a lawsuit.
How about the government?
That's a different question. I mean, so the administration is going to have to make a determination as to what if this truly was, you know, an act of invasion by the government of North Korea, and what proportional response should they exact upon them for that?
What felonies were committed that we currently know of?
Multiple. I mean, it's countless. It's just by accessing their system, stealing their information, you know, extortion. It's endless. But I mean, the little guys who are sitting behind the computers around the world or in North Korea, but probably elsewhere as well, are never going to be able to, it'd be virtually impossible to trace who those, identify who those people are.
This is Charles Lipson. I want to agree with you in saying that this is a very complicated issue about letting the U.S. government protect these organizations, because if the NSA, let's say, already has information, there's a question about whether they should be able to share that. That's one thing. But if you want to sort of have a prophylactic practice where the U.S. government uses resources to try to protect these companies, that lets them inside of private systems to a degree that's very troubling.
Well,
to me, Chris.
And let's point out that Mike Rogers, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, doped out a bill on this very subject, and it passed the United States House of Representatives in the last session of Congress. It died in the Senate over concerns such as those you mentioned.
Those need to be debated.
At the same time, Chris, and
John McCarran now.
My Republican friends at the table are sitting down, so I'm going to say something critical of Barack Obama without fear of injuring anybody. I was really taken back when he said, gee, I wish they had called me. This thing had been percolating for 3 weeks, and I'm thinking the White House hasn't been talking to Sony, or Sony hasn't been talking to the...
Well, and it turned out, of course, the CEO of Sony, within 45 minutes, recited the White House senior staffers with whom Sony had been in constant communication.
But did they get through to Valerie? That's the real question.
Are you being facetious?
So that was
No, I mean, if you really want to connect with the important figure.
But the other point I think is worth making is North Korea is kind of a crazy state, which there are a lot of crazy states out there, maybe not as crazy. But more importantly, the Seoul, Korea, is within cannon range of the border of North Korea. We have no basically conventional response to if North Korea opened hostilities on South Korea. I mean, it would immediately get totally out of hand.
Well, nobody's proposing a military response.
A lot of times I'm in discussions with pundits or even politicians who don't know a lot about the military, and they don't understand why North Korea is a special case.
I agree with Mark in saying, in effect, let's treat this the way that gated communities treat security. Inside the gated community, you know, they have their own patrols. It's hard to get in. You want to do all that. But a gated community is still also protected by the police in Austin, Texas, or Orlando, or Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the right way to look at it.
Well, I want to get to this issue of the federal government's responsibility, because of the networks in the United States, Mr. Fleshner, 15% are government or public or utilities, 85% are private. And is there not necessarily a does that not call upon policymakers to come up with ways to you know, create some kind of protection for the private networks without, you know, piercing the veil of privacy and crossing the Fourth Amendment?
Again, I'm not a IT guy or cybersecurity expert, but I don't see how we would invite the government into companies' networks, private networks, without having the problem that Big Brother is now everywhere. I mean, part of it is, I mean, part of being in America is that we each, you know, protect our own here. I get the whole border thing, and I agree with you that, and obviously the government, the federal government would have to step in on that. But it seems to me would be very troublesome, both legally and constitutionally, to invite governments into companies to try to protect their cybersecurity.
Thus spoke Mark Flessner, a partner at Holland & Knight, a former federal prosecutor, first-time guest on Beyond the Beltway. Thank you, Attorney Flessner, for making time on your Sunday night to join us in this conversation. We hope to have you back on the program and in studio, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
That's Mark Flessner.
Great
to have you on. I am Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont, joined tonight by John McCarron, Dan Miller, and Charles Lipson. Hugo Chaviano joined us for our first hour, and we're going to turn to you for your phone calls right after these words. Stay tuned.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair, see Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King this holiday season. Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Beyond the Beltway. We've got some terrific news for inveterate listeners and viewers of the program, and that is that our panelist this evening, Dan Miller, is going to be sitting in for Bruce Dumont on the TV version of Beyond the Beltway for the next couple of months. Is that right, Dan?
For the next 8 weeks, I think. While Bruce is in Southern California visiting his family, Bruce will be doing the radio program live from Southern California. I will be taping the TV version here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications for broadcast beginning Sunday evening.
And that is broadcast in Chicago on WYCC, one of the public TV
channel 20
stations out here in Chicago. Where else do people see it?
It'll be on Comcast channel 100, along with several other programs, and that will be on a loop throughout the week. So it's not unusual for people to say, oh, I saw this on TV last night, and in fact it was taped several days earlier.
And what are we looking forward to? Are we getting deep into the legendary Dan Miller Rolodex?
The program really, Chris, is going to be a one-stop shop for local government. It'll be focused, a lot of focus on the aldermanic elections coming up on February 24th, the mayoral election, and a little bit on the governor. But certainly the governor, just because of the enormous implications of the budget and so many other things. But we won't be doing the international galactic discussion that Beyond the Beltway will be handled on the radio part by Bruce.
John McCarron is wondering if you're going to do Benghazi.
Not on my program. Not on this one.
All right.
No, sorry.
John, it sounds like that's still reserved for your program.
But, John, we will be doing a lot on infrastructure.
All right.
You know how important that is.
When you're talking about these local elections, especially because this is kind of Chicago-focused, there are a lot of very intense elections going on around the entire region.
Indeed. This is a municipal approach. This is not just a narrow point of view, just on aldermanic.
We'll be welcoming all the Chicago listeners into to the program, and they can call in, you know, that sort of thing.
No call-in, it's taped. Once again,
Charles Lipson. former chairman of the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago, channeling Henny Youngman. All right. Thank you very much for that. All right. So, Dan Miller, you start up when? When's your first program?
January 3rd.
January
Sunday, which is right after the end of Downton Abbey's premiere. Just stay tuned. Go to Channel 20, WICC, and there we are.
And there you are. All right. Terrific, Dan. Congratulations, and I hope you have a great time. Are you ready for your close-up?
Of love. Yes, I am, Mr. Les Zesnick or whatever that was.
DeMille.
Mr. DeMille.
All right. So
on with the program,
please? We're going to get on with the program and take the spotlight off of Dan Miller. Our phone number, 800-723-8289, 800-723-8289. If you've got a particular gripe or a particular plaudit to state about how the president has responded to the Sony hacking or how the federal government is protecting us from international hacking, please give us a call. If you're a law professor somewhere and you know the definition of a cyber act of war, give us a call. We're looking for that, 800-723-8289. We'd love to hear from you. I think this is a moment at which the public is going to somewhat catch up with the policymakers. Here's what I mean by that. There have been hacks and there is a cyber war going on for years and years. The Chinese, the Russians, actually I worked with folks who were afflicted by a bunch of, I'm not making this up, Bulgarian coders who were attacking private interests in the United
States.
Those
are usually financial crimes, right? Purely
that
financial.
That was, but that's not what's going on when the Russians and the Chinese are going after the United States Department of Defense, the Iranians and others. John McCarran, are we ready for a complete public understanding of cyber warfare?
Well, I think the average person probably knows a little better now not to put anything in their email to someone, especially if you're sending it to a hackable organization that you don't want everybody to hear. Witness the Sony executives joking about what kind of movies President Obama might like. You know, is it Django Unchained, et cetera? They reel off the names of
racially tinged comments.
Yeah. And which, I don't know, maybe that had something to do why he said the other day that I wish they had called. I don't know. But you
can see that this is actually very serious stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I'm intrigued by the notion that China's involved. You know, China really plays – they're new to this – to the game of international brinksmanship, and they do a very rash things with their ships, with their planes. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if they abetted this hack. And to me, that puts the Fortune 500 in the United States in a tough situation, because now that they've outsourced so much of the production and jobs to China in order to save a few bucks, everyone blessed that. It was a bipartisan thing. What happens if it turns out that the government actually has to do something about the Chinese?
Do you see a role for the government as an agent of punishing this kind of activity?
I think they need to be involved, sure. I'm not as paranoid as some about government involvement in business. I've always thought public-private partnerships are the way to go.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about government involvement in punishing.
Look, if something isn't done to punish the people who hacked Sony, other people are going to be hacking other companies.
It should not
be proportionate. There has to be some retribution.
It should not be proportionate. It should be disproportionate. That we don't want to provoke war. We shouldn't take military actions. But there's no reason why North Korea, which is a state sponsor of terrorism, indeed it made a terrorist threat associated with this, shouldn't be back on that list. What? There's no reason why the bank in Macau shouldn't be sanctioned again.
So how do
again.
We play hardball with China, then, if that's where this takes us? I mean, where does that leave
Let me say something about China. First of all, I don't think that you want to make this into a public thing with China if you can avoid it. Secondly, China's foreign policy changed dramatically several years ago. Until then, China's position was, hold, bide your time, we're rising, we'll have more power in the future, don't push it. Now they've revved up the nationalism. They're pushing very hard in the South China Sea. They're taking very aggressive nationalistic stances. And there has been a responsive nationalism in both Japan and in South Korea. This is a very explosive situation. We need to be very careful as we do it. But make no mistake, China has been a big bully in the region.
To answer your question, John McCarron, and Charles mentioned the bank in Macau, which is used by many of the elites in North Korea to access the international banking system. And we mentioned earlier House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers, who was on one of the Sunday talk shows today, said his problem with the president's press conference this week was not that he had a press conference. See, he should have been announcing at that press conference what he had already done and what he would keep doing to the Korean elites. And so there is we have a national technical capability, essentially, to shut down their access to the international banking system.
That's happened several times, by the way, Chris, where he's made a speech that's actually harmed what he could do. When he initially made his speech about ISIS before we did anything, they were masked in very visible things. He should have announced, we just bombed, rather than we're going to bomb in a week or two. When he made his speech about Cuba, he did a moral equivalence statement that I found really disturbing. You know, we used to be an imperial nation, and they're a communist.
And you might see us as colonialists great reason.
Good Lord, defend us, for heaven's sake.
John?
Well, everything's got to be brought back to a bash of Obama on Beyond the Beltway.
Exactly.
I mean,
right.
That's what it's about.
You've mastered it.
There we go.
Did I go too far? Too soon, John? Too soon? You're still holding out hope for a successful president?
Do you remember bashing Bush, or has that all dropped out of central memory?
I don't think I was on the show all that much during the Bush era.
Ouch.
But I'm still,
it lives on the internet, I mean, you know.
The trouble with brinksmanship with China is that iPhone in your pocket, Charles, was made there. And
I'm not trying to do.
We're totally in bed.
Okay, but do you think that we should? I don't know. This is an honest question. Should we be targeting members of the elite in North Korea? Because of this.
That's what I was arguing.
I gave the Macau Bank.
Another one, John, and this is serious. It comes from the Wall Street Journal. And what they said to do is put that movie on a thumb drive, attach it to balloons, and send it over North Korea. Don't laugh. That's all that's done regularly now with transistor radios. That's how the word gets out in North Korea in many cases. This is done by an agency that sends these things over on balloons. Do that. At least it's a way to say North Korea, are not going to stop the United States from seeing a movie, how dumb it is.
You agree something should be done.
Yeah. I'm not a fan of Seth Rogen or B movies. I think the movie was a stupid idea to make in the first place. But we can't have another. I agree with the president totally. We can't have another dictator telling us what we can and can't see in our media.
Well, in one sense it was a dictator, but in one sense it was Sony telling us. I mean, the dictator made the threat, but it was Sony that caved.
Oh, I'm not so sure that Sony caved. I mean, the way the movie business works, you know, the studios make these films, distributors get involved to distribute the films, and then the theaters have to show the films.
Right.
And only 50% of the ticket price goes back to the guys who made it.
Just imagine if the movie were shown in Old Orchard and there were an attack. It's not attack and not an attack against the movie house in Old Orchard. It could have destroyed and hurt.
Mitt Romney had
thousands.
The best suggestion, actually, where he said that essentially you put it out. You could either do it on the internet or DVDs, and ask people to make donations to Ebola charity.
There you go. That's Charles Lipson. I'm Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. We're going to be back right after these words. Stay with us.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Good evening, everybody. Hope you're enjoying your last Sunday before Christmas. It's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. We're delighted you have joined us at Beyond the Beltway. And we're talking about the Sony hack. Alan of Park Ridge, Illinois, listening to us on the Big 89 WLS. Your call, your question for the panel, please.
Yeah, hello, gentlemen. I'm sorry Bruce is there today, but nice panel. My question is, hypothetically, let's say the shoe is on the other foot here, and there's a despotic nation who has a film industry, who has a despotic leader who decides to turn the tables on us and provide a film for to anybody who where the profile is that they assassinate the American president or they send a convoy over here to do that.
Right.
How do you think we would react to that?
Well, we know how we would react because during the Bush administration, there were films out, and actually plays too, I believe, but certainly films about the assassination of the president. That's just free speech.
John
unless
has forgotten
it's a specific
all of that,
threat. Unless it's a specific threat. So, in other words, if you burn a cross on somebody's yard, that's a threat to that person, and that person takes it as a threat. Whereas if you're making a movie or you're stating something in very general terms, then it's not. And so it's just free speech.
Alan, a quick question, and then we'll bid you farewell. Quick question is, do you agree that we should do something to North Korea because of this attack?
I don't know how much our sanctions are delving. I mean, I don't know what more we could do that we're not doing already.
Okay.
Alan, I think Alan raises an interesting point, and it's a philosophical point. Other cultures that did not go through the Western experience and the Enlightenment and wind up with the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment, other cultures have a different idea of what you ought to do and what's proprietary, what's proprietous and what's not. And I mean, what if someone at another studio out in LA said, gee, boys, look at all this free publicity. We're not as scared of that. Let's make a movie about Allah. Okay. Wow. Then, I mean, what would happen then? Would
well,
that
we know
be,
what happens? All... That guy goes to jail.
Yeah. That guy is still in jail.
Well,
and that was a clip. That was a nothing, you know,
a nothing burger. But
well,
you're right.
But I mean, I hope that my point is at least understood. In that,
what is the point?
And that is, other cultures have a different attitude about what is can be said without blaspheming.
We're going to say thank you. Hold on one second. We're going to say thank you to Alan, and let's go over to Arlington Heights outside of Chicago. Charlotte is listening to us on WLS. Go ahead, Charlotte. Your question right away, please.
Hi. Are we afraid of North Korea? They are.
We ought to be.
Military. They have a nuclear weapon, possibly long-range nuclear missiles, the ability to launch a satellite. In other words, a weapon into the atmosphere.
And so therefore we should do what?
Well, their leader is crazy. I don't know.
Okay.
But it's a good point. I would say
they're an irrational actor.
At this point,
with very
they're not
serious
a threat
weapons.
Directly to the United States except by sabotage, but they are a direct threat to the South Koreans, and in particular, they have over 40,000 conventional short-range missiles that could reach Seoul. Seoul is very near the border, and this is a serious problem.
Well, that's what she's saying. Yeah.
So does that mean that they've this is extortion, and we cannot overcome North Korea?
At this point, it's not clear whether they have a deliverable nuclear device. What has stopped us from doing anything more, even in the early 90s, when there was a real serious consideration in 1994 of going to war against North Korea. It was ultimately stopped by Jimmy Carter going in as a freelancer and striking a deal on their nuclear reactors. But the big price would be how much damage could be done to Seoul. This is not something you could stop with Iron Dome.
Well, let me say, I'm glad you mentioned that because it gives me an opportunity, and I hope John is sitting down, to say I was one of the Republicans who was very bitterly disappointed with the last 2 years of diplomacy towards North Korea of the Bush administration, at which time Condoleezza Rice took over the North Korea desk and said they're no longer a sponsor of state terrorism, when basically every intelligence organization in the world understood that they were still sponsors of state terrorism. And for reasons I still don't understand, Condoleezza Rice negotiated, or I'm sorry, she orchestrated a series of concessions from which we have seen no change in behavior. Now, what does that tell us about our proper posture towards North Korea?
Well, it certainly shows that there are limits to the way we can influence the behavior of other countries, just as we were talking about the folks in Havana in the last hour. It's not like the United States has strings we can pull here and there to make them do what we want. It's a very indirect influence.
Well, are we seeing something about concessions not leading to better international behavior?
The analogy to Cuba is perfect, John, because the problem with North Korea and the problem with Cuba is that the hardline policies didn't produce the outcomes we wanted. So people said, well, why not change the policy, see if that leads to anything better? I think you're right in saying that Condoleezza Rice taking off the sanctions against the bank and taking them off the terror list didn't lead to changes, but her argument would have been the same as President Obama's argument about Cuba, namely that the old policy hadn't worked either.
Dan Miller, was it time for us to still be tough on North Korea?
Certainly, yes, absolutely. They'll wither on the vine.
It's Dan Miller, Charles Lipson before that, and John McCarron before that. We also want to thank our other guests, Hugo Chaviano, who joined us in the first hour to talk about Cuba and developments there, Mark Flessner in the second hour to talk about cybersecurity. Beyond the Beltway is a Genebee production produced in association with WLS Radio. I also want to thank Colin Bobbitt, Dylan Klauke, and Dan Dorfman for helping get this program on the air tonight. Until next week, when Bruce DeMott's going to be back on the air, this is Chris Roebling substituting and wishing you a very good night and a warm holiday season from Chicago.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King this holiday season. Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.